It is Friday, the 27th of October, 2017, and this is the Simon Dell Show. First of all, we're no longer the Simon Dell Podcast, and we're now the Simon Dell Show. It's a little change, but we figured that maybe one day we'll evolve from a podcast into something else. So we thought, why not get the name changed right at the start so that we're all happy and comfortable with Simon Dell Show. We've got a fantastic episode for you today. As usual, we've got the spin cycle coming up with Eddie and Patrick, and lots of dad jokes from Patrick as usual. But also we have a fantastic long form interview with the CEO of River City Labs, Peter Ellis. Now, River City Labs is one of those startup spaces, and just by calling it a startup space is probably not even doing it in the slightest bit of justice. But you have to listen into what Peter's got to say. She is got a huge amount of experience in the startup space. And we're not really going to talk, funnily enough, about the startup space. We're going to talk about her experience in business, how she got to where she got to, and the challenges that she faces running River City Labs as a CEO and working with her family as well. So it's really eye-opening, really interesting. So please make sure you get to hang around and listen to that. Otherwise, let's get straight into the spin cycle. Welcome to another edition of The Spin Cycle, and my co-hosts with me today.
Hey!
The Michelin star of co-hosts, we have Dr. Edwina Luck from QUT.
Hello,
and the
hello.
TripAdvisor one-star review of co-hosts, we have
wow.
Patrick Condren. How are you both today?
Pretty awesome after that intro, I must say.
Now I'm going to have to keep that up every week.
No, you can't.
How are you, Patrick?
I've gone
very quiet there.
Well, I'm just waiting for the dust to settle. I mean, you bag me every single cotton picking week.
I'll get it.
You need to get a new routine. The ham's gone off.
dear, look, and so what we're going to do is we're going to start this week because I believe Edwina, so stunned with the creation of our new word last week, exagerating.
Hang on. There's no wee pale face. This is all you.
With the creation, my creation of the word exagerasplaining last week, Edwina has found her own example of exagerasplaining. So take it away, Edwina.
Yeah, I think I found one of the first ones in the perfume world. Back in 2007, Calvin Klein, and now you boys may have actually worn this, but
no.
it was Into You. It was a cologne for men who were called technosexuals. Technosexuals. It was designed perfectly and beautifully for technosexuals from the bottle to also being launched in Second Life, where you could spray virtual partners with fizzing fragrance bubbles to initiate dialogue.
So these are people that have sex with computers.
Nearly, but no. One of the taglines that the marketers used was, "She likes how he blogs. Her texts turn him on. It's intense for right now."
Is that exagerasplaining or is that just stupid?
That's a fantastic example of exagerasplaining.
Mm-hmm. And it could be used now because we've got this tech-reliant younger generation, you know, hip 20-somethings. And, I just love it.
And just for everyone's benefit, we as I said last week, we've got our Instagram feed now. So we'll make sure. Have you found a picture from that, Eddie?
Because
that
I'm
would be great to
now.
Put up
yes,
on there.
Yes, I'll send you the link.
Right. Well, we'll get that up onto Instagram, and
it's
you can all have
racy.
A look at that.
So is it a bit racy?
don't get me started, Eddie. For God's sake.
Well, you think of Kate Moss. She was the original Calvin Klein girl. So, anyway,
do you want to take it from there? Do you want to give us your story this week?
From technosexuals to adopting a dog. Yes,
we've adopted two dogs at our joint.
I was going to ask you guys. So you've got two dogs, Pat.
Why do you ask two dogs?
That's right.
Yes, we do. Via the RACQ, RSPCA, we got a dog, a Jack Russell, with an underbite. And then in the last few months, we've adopted an ex-racing greyhound. It's been out of racing for about 4 months. And it's got an overbite, so they match each other perfectly.
Little pigeon pair, how beautiful. Well, Pedigree for years have been saving a shelter dog, they call it in America, but we have adopt a dog here in Australia. And they also, Pedigree also say that when you buy their products, some aspect of food donations or something for particular dogs, they donate to them. So what they've done now is they've teamed with Facebook and create, because, you know, they've got Facebook masks now. So Pedigree thought, hey.
What's a Facebook mask?
Well, it's like an Insta.
Like a filter.
Yeah, filter, I know what you're talking about. A Snapchat filter, yeah. So it's really cool. What they've done is that they've got commonly found breeds that you would find in your shelter, like possibly for you, Pat, you know, you've got your greyhound and your little Jack Russell, and you put a mask of the dog on your face, and if you like it, you nod, and then instantly it comes up with a location base. So they're using location of where you'd find Joey the dog or an Mary.
But if you've already got a dog, why would you need another one?
Well, because you've got two.
Yeah, fair enough.
Mm. But if you go no, then it goes on to the next breed. So it's really, really clever. But obviously, the great thing about this campaign is that it is location-based, as I mentioned, but it's also, if you are not tech-savvy and you don't know how to use Facebook masks, then you're not going to be able to actually engage with this campaign.
Can I say, I think it's absolutely outrageous. It is nothing more than a craven attempt to prey on people's desires to help poor unfortunate beasts that are looking for a home and to make money out of it via their products. I think it's appalling, absolutely appalling.
What, Facebook are making money?
He says it's outrageous every week. Something's outrageous.
Well, this week, this is outrageous.
Surely it's a great idea to be able to get more dogs adopted and into homes.
Absolutely.
Surely
how many have they adopted?
How can you criticize
that?
It's just a new campaign. It only started like a week ago.
So how many have they done in a week?
I don't know.
Well, that's my point, because I think
results.
Are they adopting? Are they adopting out the dogs, or are they just recommending breeds for you to adopt?
Well, you know how research shows that many pet owners actually look like their pets. So this is a campaign that plays on that.
So you're saying I look like the Jack Russell or the greyhound?
I'm not sure. I've got to see photos.
Some sort of bizarre combination of the two, to be honest. That's what
I think.
Yeah,
the overbite and the underbite.
Wow. Yeah. I sign up for this abuse every Monday.
The thing is, Pat, that, you know, we put down up to nearly about 7 million dogs a year in Australia. So if we can
absolutely outrageous.
Yeah, it is. It is disgraceful.
Absolutely.
But if Pedigree have got this campaign that, you know, they're going to try and do it online instead of offline to get actually people to a vet or to the RSPCA or to wherever they're looking.
But the RSPCA can't adopt all the animals they've got already.
Oh, no.
And then when you get tied up in the greyhound world, they can't, you know, they foster, and there's just so many animals that end up getting put down because they just can't give them away.
No, and horses as well. Horses is another issue.
So I think this is an appalling campaign, a craven effort to prey on people's good nature to make a buck.
I guess the short-term issue here that I would perhaps more eloquently say than Patrick is that surely this is people reacting quickly to saying, yes, I want that dog, or I don't want that dog, or that breed, and they're not really giving it much thought about whether a dog should be, whether they can look after a dog or,
That's
you know,
true.
Take on the responsibilities. So it seems to me that it's kind of tapping into a, a sort of an Insta fame or Insta decision that people perhaps need to think through a little bit further.
I would say that there's another T word to address this, and that's tacky.
Well, yes.
It's clever use of technology, and it's another marketing communication tool that Pedigree have looked at. But, Pat, once some results come out, I will try.
Let's make a note and let's prove him wrong, Eddie, next week or the next couple of weeks. So while he's being angry there, Pat, what have you brought to the spin cycle this week?
Well, you can't help but notice that Qantas has been in the media a lot in the last week. And part of the reason why is they flew 30 journalists to the United States to see a Dreamliner being assembled, and they flew them back in another one, and they got all this free publicity. And I think it was a marketing coup to be able to do that. And, you know, it was dressed up as news, and it's nothing like news. It is, in fact, free advertising for Qantas. And I say good on them.
So the question I've got for you for this one is, so there was 30 journalists on there.
Well, yeah, journalists and cameras from, and from different networks, etc. Okay.
So presumably the major networks were represented, the major publications, et cetera. Do you think, and you're going to have to be honest with this one, do you think as a journalist you'd have walked off that plane at the end and gone, you know what, this is so obviously a junket that they want me to write something nice about them that I'm not
I wouldn't have got on the plane in the first place. Yes.
Really? Your principle sort of held that?
It depends on how it was dressed
strong.
Up. But I would, if the opportunity to go to the States for free and be wined and dined by Qantas, I would really, really enjoy. And if I did produce anything at the end of the day, it would resonate with the facts that I had been provided with this opportunity, that it was, I would make sure it wasn't a news story. So if I was, I suppose, a freelance journalist, I could do that. But if you're being paid by someone, and the boss said to me, as a political editor, can you go on this Qantas flight to the United States and report on the Qantas stuff? I would say no.
Do you think it brings your, what's the word I'm looking for, into question?
Integrity? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But having said Media Watch is obviously doing something on this very thing because I've just noticed on Twitter that a breakfast morning host has obviously taken part in the particular junket, and that's what they call them, junkets, in response to the Media Watch Twitter tweet about it, and says, and she says, I've contacted Qantas. Qantas lost and found about my integrity, just like my sunglasses, no luck. So she's being upfront about it and taking the mic a little bit. But I suppose I applaud Qantas because, you know, everyone is out to make as much publicity as they possibly can for the least amount of money. And this is terrific. It got them a week of stories on the mainstream media.
What do you reckon, Eddie?
I think you can do it a lot better. But in a bigger picture, I don't know if I'm going to disagree with you on this one, Pat, not because you disagreed with my Pedigree story, but Qantas have they're unveiling their latest campaign, which is all about celebrating real people, real pilots, real people who work for the airline. And they've got about five or six television commercials, just 30 seconds that are, if they're not out now, they're all on YouTube. And it profiles, you know, real people. And I'm not saying journalists aren't real people because they certainly are, but it's they're showing this airline to be, you know, they use these voiceovers like, oh, the sound of the jet engines and the smell of fuel. I was hooked and I had to go and work for them. And then I love public relations and I think you can do some great publicity, but it's you've got to make sure that the publicity that you're generating is authentic. When the ad campaign that they're showing is authentic, there's no consistency. There's no synergy.
Can't they sort of run in parallel? I mean, you've got what is obviously blatantly Qantas advertising, paid for advertising via the mechanisms that you've outlined, and then you've got this other, parallel advertising, for want of a better word, in the mainstream media, in the news. So you've got Qantas in the news, on the breakfast television shows, in the papers, on the wireless, and so people, I think, are smart enough to differentiate between that and paid for Qantas advertising. So I don't see one being a negative impact on the other. I see them running in parallel, and I see it as a clever opportunity from Qantas to get all this free advertising on the mainstream media.
My question on this one would be, let's say they had not put 30 journalists on that plane and they put 30 sick kids on that plane. Do you think they would have got more or less media coverage?
What are the sick kids? Why are they on there?
Oh, just for an experience. Take them to Disneyland.
They flew them over there in one of the old planes. You go through the factory seeing the new Dreamliner being built, then you fly them home. Yeah. I mean, it's the same sort of thing that happens in the travel pages of the newspapers, where travel journalists are provided with an overseas trip or a trip anywhere, and they write about the experience. But at the end they say, you know, this was provided by the author traveled courtesy of, you know, Billy Blogg's travel. And that's the way that they make the point that they are, you know, it's being paid for. But, you know, none of the news stories that I saw indicated that Qantas at the end of it had flown them there and paid for everything. So that's the point there.
Yeah.
Qantas was being clever, because it would have cost them nothing to get all this free publicity on the mainstream media.
Certainly not the first junket. That journalists have
not.
And I suspect it will
one of my
be
favourite jokes was in Rockhampton, sitting in a what do they call them? Black Hawk helicopter being flown around. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Fantastic.
Well, that would have been awesome. Yeah. I wouldn't have been in the lounge up there.
So we'll move on to what?
I want a six pack, whatever she's drinking.
We'll move on. We'll move on to my one for this week, and I was going to talk about I'm going to share it on the Instagram page anyway, because I think the Timberland advert that's targeting millennials with the line "You're never going to be able to retire, so why should your boots?"
Brilliant.
I know, and you know, honest advertising to millennials there, and I'm going to share that one anyway. Excuse me. But the one I wanted to focus on this week, because I think this is an interesting story about the changing face of media and sports media, was how Facebook was trying to convince UEFA's media bosses to let it stream the Champions League in countries where it isn't shown on TV. So obviously you can, if you want to watch the Champions League in Australia, you can buy Fox Sports and tune into that. You get the highlights on SBS and all those kind of things. But there's many countries around the world, mainly a lot of African and Indian subcontinent countries, where the UEFA Champions League isn't available on any terrestrial or satellite TV services. So Facebook are trying to bridge that gap. And it also taps into a great story about how Mamma Mia, and my God, we all love Mamma Mia, about how they're going to stream the Women's Big Bash League live via their website. So the question I've got is whether you guys see that this is a start of a shift of broadcasting sports, especially sports, but you know, other things, from the traditional broadcasters, the Sevens of this world and so on, to these online platforms, be they social media platforms, be they websites, all those kind of things, and whether we're going to see more of it, or whether this is just a once-off opportunity that Facebook and Mamma Mia are jumping on, and we won't see the holistic shift.
Facebook have been trying now with their Facebook Watch, which was what that debuted in August. So they have, at the moment, I think about 40 shows ranging partners, like different viewing. So this is just another way for Facebook to tap, as you say, into this world and own this space. They've done it with digital advertising, and they've certainly they're looking to steal a lot of money, basically, into that Facebook Watch feature.
I think you'll find that is the future of broadcasting. People will not access it via their televisions. They might stream something onto a screen on their wall, on a bigger screen via their computers, like Apple TV these days. But I think you will see the demise of broadcast towers as such, and television stations, television license holders will distribute their content via mobile devices and laptops rather than via the signal out of the towers, for example, here in Brisbane on Mount Cootha.
Yeah, and I totally agree. And I mean, when you look at the numbers already, Facebook have already apparently broadcast 3,500 different live sporting events in the first 6 months of this year. So they're already making,
for example, in the news industry, I suppose, is something that I'm more au fait with. I do a Facebook live event from Parliament House talking about the stupidity of election date speculation at the moment, and it gets 100,000 views. Now, that night on the news, the entire news got 150,000 viewers. People can watch at their leisure. I think mainstream media in Australia is behind a lot of the developed countries in the rest of the world in terms of utilising this technology, but that is the way everyone's going. That's the way all the management are talking as to how best to utilise the technology that we've got rather than the new technology that we've got rather than the old technology. And I, you know, my kids, they don't, we watch TV, we stream TV via Apple TV. We don't watch free-to-air TV. They watch stuff on their tablets or on their smartphones. And I think you'll find that when it comes to sport, in your specific case, Simon, that you know, there's a much bigger audience there that is demanding access to those big sporting events like the Champions League on their mobile devices so that they can watch it where and when they like.
And they usually don't have internet issues too, because they've got balloons going over or satellites or whatever.
They haven't got the NBN.
Tap into these things.
So I think it's the way of the future, and it'll be upon us. It'll be upon us before we know, because as you know, the television rules or the mediaship ownership laws in Australia are changing, and so I think you'll see, you know, if CBS buy 10, you look at the sort of technology that CBS utilises and what they would do to the landscape, to the media landscape in Australia, technologically wise. And I think it's a good thing, and it's the way of the future.
It's I always thought, what would it have been? It would have been about 18 months ago when Optus got the rights to the English Premier League in Australia, and everybody was up in arms because they were complaining that the only way that you'd be able to watch Premier League football is to have an Optus phone or an Optus connection, and a lot of people didn't want to switch and things like that. But couple of months back, Optus produced some fairly I'm assuming these are fairly good results from their point of view in terms of the growth of their subscribers year on year. That seems to have shown that investment has paid off for them. So if I remember rightly, it was a 3-year deal. So they're probably into the second year now. And it'd be interesting to see what happens with the Premier League when they renegotiate that, because that's going to be a very hot property that people want to get involved with.
Mr. Zuckerberg might make an offer as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. Anyway, thank you very much for that, guys. It was all very serious, that last one there, wasn't it? There was less name calling. There was less references to
what did you say,
poo?
You pillicky poo?
And
and technosexuals.
And technosexuals, yeah. So it's been another highly enjoyable experience. And so once again, thank you to my co-hosts, as we're now going to call them, because we've moved on from guests. We've promoted them up the rank.
Nice.
you passed your, what do you call it?
Probation.
The three-month probation, yeah. Congratulations. I'll have the contracts in the post to you. And I'll see you both next week. I'm extremely lucky to be joined today by an old friend of mine, Peter Ellis, who is currently the CEO of River City Labs. I shan't explain who River City Labs are. I'm sure she'll get a chance to do that. So welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much for having me.
Start off just a little bit about talking about your role and what you're doing now. So tell us who River City Labs are. The people listening to this who don't know who River City Labs are. So if you could let us know who they are and what you do, that would be fantastic.
Sure. So I'm currently the CEO of River City Labs, which is a central hub for startup activity based in Brisbane. So the company itself is 5 years old. It was originally started out as a smallish 550 square meter space in Fortitude Valley, founded by Steve Baxter, who's an entrepreneur in Brisbane, but also most recently more famous for being one of the sharks on Shark Tank. So he saw a gap in the market to, you know, provide the right environment, workspace, and home for entrepreneurs in Brisbane back in 2012, which then sort of morphed into being a lot more than that, what it is today. But we'll talk about the journey of that a little bit later on. I came on board only a couple of months after they opened. I had a bit of a background in marketing and PR and events, and saw an opportunity to bring the business world together with the tech world and sort of create different collaborative opportunities for a lot of the technical people who are sitting in there running their startups to either learn more and connect with people outside of their environment. I started off as a community manager and marketing person. And it has grown significantly in the last few years, and now we sit in a great, amazing, beautiful 1,300 square meter space in a startup precinct in Fortitude Valley, the old TC Byrne building. It's three levels. We are an anchor tenant in here, so we're one of 16 different tenants in this building. And we now are a combination space of workspace for entrepreneurs, and we are home to three different accelerators. One of those is our flagship accelerator, River City Labs Accelerator, which is 6 months long, and then we're home to two others, an Unearth Accelerator and a Slingshot Accelerator as well, which is focused on tourism, travel and hospitality sector. So we also host a range of events, all tailored towards startup education, entrepreneur education, and hopefully creating better founders at the end of all of that. Hopefully that's a bit of a wrap-up.
Wow, that's, yeah. And you're in charge of all of that.
It is true. It is true. I am. Yes.
And there's a point that you just mentioned in there that sort of brings me back to where you started off from. You originally studied tourism, didn't you?
Look, I know that my LinkedIn profile may say that, Simon, but being a great marketer, it's all about, if I can't spin up good shit for my own profile, you wouldn't want me to work on yours. So I did, you will see on there that it did say deferred, so I certainly didn't complete anything.
Right,
but
okay.
Also, I may not have possibly started it either. I certainly enrolled and I got the ball rolling, but
so what you're saying is there's an element of fluff on your LinkedIn
well, there may be a small extension of the truth, we'll call it. But look,
and only early on as well.
Yeah, very early on. But look, back then there was no online, you didn't study stuff online. It was physical. You had to turn up in person, or they sent you the workbooks. And I was based in Noosa at the time. I was enrolled at Southern Cross University. I chose to be an external student because of the course I wanted was down in Lismore. And
right.
I either moved to Lismore or I did it remotely. And to do that, they had to send me the coursework remotely, which was literally sending massive, like six ring binders full of study materials, and I got it. And knowing my learning style, it's all impersonal. It doesn't happen at all. I just got the books and thought, no, this is not for me.
I can imagine. I can imagine your face when those ring binders came through.
They came through, and I just thought, you know what? This is not the university life that I thought I was going to be having. I was still just me in a one-bedroom apartment in Noosa, and it just didn't really gel. So.
I was going to say the choice of Noosa versus Lismore.
I know.
No disrespect to anybody who lives in Lismore. But.
Hey, look, I did drive down there and check it out to just make sure that it was going to be the wrong decision. And anyway, so no. Look, it would have been a great course. The attraction for me at the time was part of the course was actually to be based somewhere overseas, working in an international hotel.
Yeah.
So there was always an interest for me for tourism and business, and knowing that obviously business, I always thought if you had business skills, you could work anywhere in the world. There was an attraction to hotels just because I think pretty much they're a universal operation. So if you sort of learn the skills in one hotel, you could pretty much work around the world. And that was always just a huge driver for me in those early days. Yep.
So I mean, I guess that takes you to your first job out of university. That itself was a small business, which is obviously where you and I first met all those years ago.
Yes, it's true. Well, actually,
I'm trying to remember the name of that bar.
Mark. It was called The Mark. Yeah. I got that job with. I went there. I got it. I was feeling like a failure because I had some businesses before working there. Which didn't go so well. I signed up to a ridiculously long lease as a small solo startup founder, which it wasn't called startups back then. You just had businesses. I signed my life away for a five-year lease on a building that was way too big for my needs. I didn't have anybody to ask about how to do these things properly, so I just sort of went in boots and all and learnt the hard way. So to get out of that, I had to go back and get a job. And that job happened to be at that place. I saw an ad for a function and event coordinator. I thought I could do that. But luckily for me, I met some amazing people there. One of them was you, which was great, but also some really good relationships for me were started at that time. But I also worked for a great entrepreneur and founder who was a chef, but he also highlighted for me the power of marketing, which I then learned from him, also the power of PR and personal relationships to create influence.
You learned marketing from a chef?
Yes, would you believe? I know it sounds crazy,
do you know what?
Right?
I've known a lot of chefs in my time and I would not believe that at all.
Yes, I know. But I tell you what, this guy, he had every single media outlet in the palm of his hands. And
really?
I just thought, how the hell is he doing this? So working with him, everything was all personal relationships. Like forget press releases, forget, you know, email. You know, we were doing standard email, but it certainly was not like now where it pretty much dominates your entire day and your schedule. It was all personal relationships. Every time he had something to announce or he wanted to get them to try something new on the menu, he would just invite them in for lunches and build personal relationships. And on the back of that, he had the ability to ask for anything and get ridiculous amounts of coverage because, one, he was just a nice guy. He was extremely real. He was very open and shared his personal life and business life together, which I think in return generated a lot of respect from people. So I looked at that and thought, wow, this is quite fascinating. So I then was fascinated with the power of PR because that venue, as you know, you went there, it was stuck out in the Toombul where there was no units at the time there. So the owner was way ahead of his time. If he had done that 10 years after, it would still be there today. But there was not the right demographic. They were they created a beautiful sort of Fortitude Valley or New Farm style venue out at Toombul at a time which was not ready for it. But he still managed to get all the media there and host crazy events and get it filled every time just because he did amazing public relations.
That's fascinating, especially from a chef.
I know.
But
he was also a great chef. But he just I think he'd learned it as well that he needed to have those personal relationships. He had a suburban restaurant as well. Again, it was in the back street of a suburb. It had no general foot traffic for anyone looking to you know go and dine, but still managed to get booked out every single night because he was just in the media all the time.
Is that something? I mean, obviously, that's a lesson that's resonated with you.
It did, massively.
Is that something you still sit there today and go, you know, the importance of relationships and you talk about that to other people as well?
Absolutely. It is the number one thing. So from on the back of that, that was my number one driver to go on and do only PR after that, because I just saw the value that most people in all of their marketing efforts were missing. They were just basically spamming everyone their information without any care or concern for who was going to be reading it or who actually what the journalist actually wanted, but also the personal relationship. So as we know, it's less important now just because the power of journalism is not the same as it was back then. Before we only had, you know, newspapers and magazines and lifestyle magazines to sort of drive patronage in any of those venues, but now the internet has changed all of that. So we have different types of influencers. But again, it's still all personal relationships, and it's basically the number one focus for any activity that I do is to make sure that we have, or anyone in our team or any businesses that I work with or mentor, always goes back to who can you build personal relationships with that will create value down the track for your business. Because that individual, even though whatever role they're in right now, they will move on to other things, and those relationships carry on those other roles.
Yeah, that's a huge point, I think.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize that. I used to work with a guy years and years ago when I worked in nightclubs, and he had a motto. His motto was never miss an opportunity.
Yeah.
And by that, he always used to say, go and have a coffee with someone, go and have a drink with them, spend some time with them, just talk to them. Yeah. Even if there's nothing that you can gain from them at that point, or there's nothing that you can share with them, I make it sound like it's a one-way street that you're trying to gain stuff from them. He would say that somewhere along the line, that relationship may come back and help you out in 1 year, 5 year, 10 years' time.
Yeah, absolutely. But you have to do it with the intent that you're not expecting anything or that you don't expect it to come back, but it would be fantastic if it did.
Yeah.
But also it was about trying to be helpful. Okay, here's someone who has who is in a position of influence that they could possibly, you know, give you some exposure, but how could you be helpful to them? So forget about your own agenda. What do they actually look for? So I've always tried to be the most helpful person in a sector or a space, whatever I'm in at the time, to make sure that if they rang me that they could get something out of me with little fuss and with really fast turnaround, because then when you did actually want something, they would be much more willing to help you simply because you already got some credits, if you know what I mean, or they actually just like you as a human because you genuinely are there to be of assistance or helpful or share knowledge somewhere along the line.
Do you find, and I'm gonna go off on a tangent here I listen to a podcast, Tim Ferriss podcast, who, you know, obviously I try and shape this a little bit on what he does. But he had a great interview with a guy called Derek Sivers, who actually, funnily enough, has now taken a polar opposite approach and says pretty much no to everything now. Because he felt that he was living in a world where he was saying yes to everything. He was trying to be accommodating to everybody.
Yeah.
And it was no longer resonating with him. It wasn't helping him anymore. Do you think that's just a different personality type, or that you need to adjust yourself to being that super helpful person?
No, I think it comes down to what stage you're at in either your own journey or your role in a business or stage of a company. So I think there's times where you do, if you're starting out and you need to build relationships, I really do believe that, or if you're trying to raise your own profile to be that voice of expertise in a certain sector, I think you do need to go quite hard at being that most helpful person. But there are times when you do need to retreat a little bit and you realise that like, are you getting anything out of all of that activity?
Yeah.
And are you spending too much time on stuff that's not going to give you any return when you could be investing that time in something more valuable to your organisation? So for me personally now, I now weigh up opportunities. If I get emailed all the time, I get phone calls all the time asking to go to things, to speak on a panel or to go to this event or go to that event. So now for me, I just don't have the time to go to all of those things. As much as I have a massive fear of missing out if I don't go, I have to just let it go and think, okay, is there someone there that I really need to meet? Is there something that I can gain from that? Or do I need to touch base with someone because I've sent them something and it'd be nice to have that personal contact? Or do I need to sell something? So I do a little bit of an assessment now rather than just saying yes to all those things just because of time. And there's probably, you know, much more valuable time that I can spend doing really important things for this business.
I'm glad this was considered valuable time spent. So thank you.
But see, this is one of those personal relationships that you just think,
absolutely,
you know what?
That comes back to haunt you, ladies.
Yeah. I did think, where the hell is this podcast going? What's it going to be about? But look, I trust you, so I'm going with it.
Well, it's funny, and something you just touched on there about fear of missing out. I had a similar conversation with a previous guest, and it's funny that people, I'm going to say, this is a horrible expression, I'll say, yep, people of our age,
yes,
that joke about millennials, yep, and their FOMO,
yep,
that we still have that same FOMO, but it's totally just evolved into something else now. It's, yes, evolved into, yes, a business FOMO.
I know. It's a bit sad, but, you know, we are there, so we have to embrace it. But, look, I think also because, I mean, especially for me in this space, I was pretty much involved in most things. So now when I hear about things that I don't know about, I do have massive fear of missing out. Plus, I could, you know, I'm just a busybody, so I like to know what everyone's doing to be on top of it. And I hate to feel like I could possibly be missing out on something.
Going back to you running your own business, obviously you did City Publicity, Red Carpet. So that was about, what, 12 years in total of those?
Yeah, about 15. So
okay.
So I started Red Carpet Projects first. That was when I left that hotel group with that, yep, amazing chef. I went out on my own and spun up exactly what I was doing there, which is marketing, public relations and events in my own company, and then took on a bunch of other hospitality venues just because that was the niche I was in and I knew that really well. But then I kicked off City Publicity, which was my attempt at digitizing,
right,
the publicity process, which was press release writing and distribution to media outlets with automated lists. So I did try. That was my attempt. Tech startup, way ahead of my time in terms of, one, I did not have the technology to make the process what it needed to be. So it was, look, it was an MVP of something that should have then been built out into a full system of process, but I did not have that technical ability nor even know what I should be doing there. And also my customers were not receptive to it then. They still wanted the very personal touch and they wanted to know who they could talk to and they wanted to be able to have those face-to-face meetings. I was trying to avoid the amount of time I spent in meetings and talking to media personally, but also on the behalf of my clients. And then also the amount of meetings I was having with clients trying to work out what they wanted to do. So it was my attempt to scale, but it didn't really work.
That's a tough space as well. The restaurant and hospitality space.
Yeah,
and everything I've experienced and still experience is that it still hasn't changed.
It is, but look, I had other clients. I was more into the retail development, property development, real estate. So I had a lot of different clients. It was just the nature of the business. But when people want a publicist, they want a publicist. They want that individual who has influence working for them. They didn't want to be working through a system. And there wasn't the cut-through. Yeah, there wasn't the deliverables at the other end. There weren't the results in the media when it was automated. There was a massive difference when you did it personally. So there was a lot more work to be done, but I couldn't wait. So I ended up ditching that in the end and then finding Rivercity Labs.
So I'm going to put you in a hypothetical situation here. If you decided tomorrow to leave Rivercity Labs and you were going to do City Publicity again,
yes,
what would you do differently this time?
Well, it's such a different space now too, so it's a bit difficult. I would have a team to start with, not try and do it on my own, and I would collaborate with other people who were doing things that would be, that would work and tie in really well with that core business because it was very much sort of a niche vertical. But now with media, it's social so heavy and much more influential than anything else. So I think that the way that even businesses now deal with influencers to get a lot of traction in the media space, social media space, is just a really, really different ballgame. But, yeah, look, I think I would, as a business, I would definitely get a team together and understand where my strengths are, because where things tend to fall down before was when I was doing everything and not focusing on the bits which I do really well and just stick to those and then get the bits. If I don't know something, that I've learned that that's actually okay. I don't need to know all the bits. I need to know about them, but I certainly don't need to be the best person to do them. Yes, I would change that.
What do you consider your strengths then? If you know, you're put in that spot and said, you know, the two, three things that you personally are really good at.
So I'm great at the ideation, the strategy, and thinking about the business as a whole and the direction. Where I normally get weighed down is the systems and processes, then executing on all the small little bits. And when now only recently I've learned, because I actually have a team now to work with, that if I can focus on those bits, we just can achieve so much more, much quicker. Whereas if I had to be the person who thought of the, you know, to do the forward planning and then also to execute on every single thing, that's where it tends to get weighed down. And plus I get a bit disinterested doing all the small process stuff. Because my happy place is sitting in the visionary space and thinking of all the new ideas and having the headspace to be able to execute on those, which is the fun part.
So obviously you went from running your own business. Tell me about how you. I don't think it's useful for us to know how you met Stephen and
yep.
at the time. What I'm really keen to understand is. How you presented yourself? What was your pitch? Because you at the time, I presume it's a small business, you're sole yep. trader, and here you are with, and he was obviously he just exited.
Yeah, he did Pipe Networks.
Yeah.
He had probably about, I don't know, 6 or 12 months before.
What was your pitch when you stand in front of him? And more to the point on that, what did you learn from that pitch that other people, you know, you sit there and say, look, you can do that too. You can stand in front of someone and pitch a business and win it.
Yeah, well, look, I didn't know who Steve was. That was probably good that I wasn't influenced or, put off or intimidated, I suppose, by who he was. Plus, he didn't have a large public profile now. He was a great – I've always worked for entrepreneurs, so I already understand the mindset. I know what makes people with those types of personalities tick. And they love executors. They're the idea of people that love people that can come in and just get stuff done. And I'm very much that person. So that's always a really good fit. But I had a friend who was working in at River City Labs, and I heard that there was a job going. I needed to supplement my income from my business. I was trying to exit out of City Publicity, but I just didn't want to drop the ball on the clients that I did have. But I was disheartened by the publicity sector and the business that I had that was just dying, so I needed to cut it off. But I needed to get a job to do that. So I went and applied for the job that was going, which was the community and event manager. But I just said, this is who I am, this is what I can do, but this is what I would like to do. And then he said, great, come back, start on Monday. So so it was pretty much as simple as that.
Yeah.
He was so straightforward, really human, no frills. And I went in there and I actually thought I had something to offer, which, you know, you've experienced it when you start businesses and they don't work out, you're feeling a bit shit about yourself and think, do I actually know anything? So I was in that space of like, I don't even know if I've got any value right now, but I know what I can do, so I'll go and do that part. And then if I can add value somewhere along the line, then great. So that's the position. I wasn't in the best place, but I certainly can sell myself, so I did and it worked, so that was good.
I guess that point when you walked in and stood in front of him, that's probably a turning point for you, wasn't it? Considering where you were and where you
absolutely.
Are.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure. Yeah. And you just never know where these things are going to go. For me, it was just a way to supplement my income in a space which I had no idea about. I didn't even know what a tech startup was. I just knew that I could do stuff in there that I knew like the back of my hand and I could bring people together. So,
did you walk out of it thinking you got it?
Yes. Yeah, straight. He told me in the
It was
a no-brainer. Yeah, it was come back on Monday. So I was like, great.
That's an amazing. It's funny how you know your life can turn on a
absolutely.
Dime, for want of an American yes. expression there.
Yeah, absolutely. Just like that. And even then, I still never really understood the value of, I suppose, what I was getting into until because I got involved, and then I thought, right. Startups, what the hell? So I started Googling, like,
book or something. Yeah. Yes.
I thought I'd better upskill. So I just went nuts researching and just looking at different communities. And I focused heavily on America. And I read, you know, I got to listen to that many podcasts and looked at different spaces, understood what – I just looked at other really successful spaces in America, looked at what events they were hosting, understanding what entrepreneurs wanting to learn, started replicating all of those here in Brisbane and just thought, right, here's a list of stuff. We just need to go gangbusters at this. And, just, you know, there were some nights when five people would come to something and you're like, what the hell, am I having any impact? And then another – then the next week there'd be 150 like, no, this is working. And then, you know, so there's so many ups and downs. But I think the key is just consistency. So I tried not to get too disheartened when things didn't quite work out or people didn't show up, because, you know, the very next week somebody would, and then I could, you know, you get great feedback from somebody that somebody got something out of one of the interactions. And for me, that was enough to know that there was value being added there and we just needed to keep going. And I always believed that there'd be a, because we were still educating people on what the startup sector was. So it was a timing thing. And what I did learn was that all of the business experience that I had myself wasn't wasted, and that I actually probably knew a lot more than I thought I did, even though I'd come out with my tail between my legs feeling a little bit broken, like I was a bit of a failure in my own businesses. But when I saw all the other people coming in, kicking off stuff, which was pretty average, I did think that maybe my businesses weren't so bad after all, and that maybe I could have made something of it had I kept going. So my motto is now, every time I think I'm not having impact or I need to give up, I just need to keep going. And then I found that I sort of give up a little bit too early. So
I think one of the key words you said there, which is something I stress to people, is consistency.
Yes.
And that's in marketing and business and your messaging and your branding and all those kind of things, is that if people are expecting to, you know, start a blog tomorrow and within 3 months be considered an influencer in that space, then they're smoking crack. But if they're consistent and they keep going, then it might be a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, whatever. But as soon as you kind of relax and drop that determination, that consistency, that's when it sort of tends to sort of trail away.
Yeah, definitely. And look, my brother did the exact same thing. He used to blog about wine. I know it sounds quite simple, but he used to go, I don't know if anyone is listening. I don't know if anyone's reading this. I don't know if I'm having any impact whatsoever. But, you know, 6 months down the track, got noticed by back then two guys who had a podcast called the Quaff Brothers, and then spun up a company called Vino Mofo, and then ended up getting employed by them, and now is head of culture at Vino Mofo, which is one of the most successful startups. Yeah, so it's just consistency, being true to what it is that you're into and in your own voice and your own style, and you never know where some of those things will lead. So that's always a good story too.
Whilst you were doing that in the early stages of River City, was there that kind of Malcolm Gladwell tipping point when you actually went, you know what, this is gonna be big? Was there a moment that you suddenly that light bulb went on, or was it just a gradual thing?
Look, it was gradual, but there was always, for me, the startup weekend events were always light bulb moments. They always were confirmation for me that we're having impact, that people are engaged, they want more out of it. And then when people come back to give more themselves voluntarily, and I think that was always confirmation for me, because that means that they wanted to be there and they could see value in themselves reinvesting their time and their skills and their energy. That was huge confirmation that this is definitely gaining some traction and that it can definitely keep growing and be bigger than just us. We always knew we would be one player, but there's a whole massive, obviously, ecosystem, and we're just one small part of it. But it needed to stem from somewhere. And as you know, people just need someone to lead. They need someone to kick something off, and then people join in. And it was nice to be, I suppose, part of that. We're definitely not the first. And I've been pulled up on this many times. People going, there was lots of activity before River City Labs. And I'm not saying there wasn't. There is, and there always was, and there's great people doing amazing things. We were just one part of a big puzzle. So
yeah, I think you guys were the first to get noticed. I think
we made a lot of noise. So,
and I say that from an objective point of view. There was a lot of noise. The media suddenly started to take it, you know, pay attention, and to all the people that were at it before, all credit to them. But I think it was you guys that really sort of went, this is a real thing?
Well, yeah, and we made a point of it. Like, we banged onto the media so hard all the time to say, hey, this is happening, this is happening. And same with government and council and corporates. We invited them in at every single opportunity that was worthwhile them coming to just keep saying, hey, this is happening, this is happening, this is what's happening here. You need to understand, you need to see it for yourself. So we didn't just, you know, send documents or papers or research or studies. We got them involved and invited them down all the time. Again, it comes back to that personal relationship thing. Mm. And, you know, a lot of the people I've met back then, it's really important to go and have a coffee or a beer with somebody,
yeah,
just to get to know them as a person, as human. So next time you see them, you can ask about their family, and then all of a sudden you can ask them to come to an event and judge on a panel or whatever it might be. It is super valuable.
I just want to talk now just a little bit about you as the personal brand, because sometimes you often find people in a position like yourself that brand, your personal brand, the Peter brand, is the River City CEO brand is different to what it is in private.
Yeah.
How much of you, the real you, is there in that CEO role?
That's a really, really good question. It's a hard one. I have different ways that I get my brain to be activated. So I have a really big job to do at work, and then I have a really big job to do at home. So I do certain things to get my brain sort of focused on one or the other. But as far as personality traits, it is definitely, you know, you're getting Peter at home and you're getting Peter at work. It's very much the same. What I have consciously tried to do, especially this year, is be a little bit more human and personable at work, probably a bit more vulnerable, let people into my life a bit more to understand me as a person. I think because before I made an effort to keep private life quite separate to work life. But what I have learned is people resonate with that personal story a little bit more. So I'm trying to be a bit more open and real in the work environment, because I find it goes much better than I thought it did.
It comes back to that point about building relationships with people. It's easier to build relationships with people where you know their history and you know their past, and there's a strong, you can build a quicker and stronger trust bond between people if you open up a bit more.
Yeah, and look, I think also because, you know, I've been a parent for 10 years now, and in that time I've also been building this career and business. So I did have an, you know, original perception for me was, don't appear to be, you know, weak or affected by personal life, because then people can't think you can do your job properly. So I did keep it quite separate in that regard, because I thought it would be a disadvantage to be seen to be doing all this stuff at home, because I didn't believe that people thought you could do your job properly if you had a lot of all that other stuff going on. But what I am learning now is that a lot of people take inspiration from, I suppose, how I structure my personal life to be able to come into work and execute as a CEO and get stuff done. So I'm trying to bring a bit more of those personal insights in and how I manage all of that. Because what I'm finding is, especially a lot of other women in the space, like to be guided or know what other people do to make it work, because they can learn from that. So that was a huge lesson for me.
Do you ever still have sort of have the panic moment where you go, shit, what am I doing here? How did I get here? What happened? What, you know?
No, look, I don't think but I do think, shit, am I the best person for this job? Like, I do think often, I think, you know, because when you've been around for a while, I got introduced, Mark Salby, bless him, is an amazing guy. He's done amazing things in his own personal life and his business life, and then also most recently as a chief entrepreneur. He introduced me on a panel as, this is Peter, she's part of the furniture at RCL. And in that moment, I was literally going to go back to Steve and resign, because I thought, fuck it, am I really just part of the furniture, or am I adding value? So I had to deal with my own brain that day and work out where my value might be.
And hopefully and that's it was funny,
more than being part of the...
Yeah, he obviously probably didn't mean it in that way.
No, absolutely. Yeah,
but it's perception, isn't it?
Perception.
Yeah.
So, and you know, I haven't been a CEO before, and there are some really amazing good CEOs out there in the world, and I often think, okay, if one was to come in, what would they do differently? Yes, I do know everything, every single aspect of the business from the ground up because I've been all the different roles. But I'm learning, and I hate being shit at something, so I will do my best to keep getting better and better and better. And so I just take different types of advice, and I get different advisors and learn more. And I've got a lot better at asking questions and understanding that if I don't know something, it doesn't mean that that's bad. It just means that I need to learn it and get better at it. So I've gotten better at that sort of thing. Upskilling, I think, is a huge part of it. So in terms of personal growth, it's been massive.
How do you that's probably another good question. How do you because putting this in context, about 18 months ago, probably 2 years ago, I sat down and had the sort of realization that whilst I'd done a lot in terms of building an agency and a team and all those kind of things, I hadn't learned anything.
Yeah.
I simply functioned to the needs and the requirements that the business needed me to function at.
Yeah.
And I hadn't, as a person, grown and all those kind of things. And so actively, perhaps in the last 12 months, and especially more so in the last 6 months, I've made a much more of a concerted effort to try and learn.
Yeah.
How do you develop yourself? Because as a CEO, it can be quite a lonely position.
Yeah, I mean, well, in this one, I don't feel lonely at all because I've got a great team and I work very closely with them, and I work with our sort of affiliate companies, and they have CEOs, and we talk a lot and learn a lot from each other. So I don't feel alone. But in terms of improvement, I think for me it's on a daily basis because there's lots of stuff that I don't know, so I make it a point to go and upskill in those areas. Plus I also look to other people in certain roles that I admire or aspire to be more like, and I then, you know, stalk them and work out what the hell they are doing, what impact they're having, why. So I'm quite interested in other people who have impact and are great leaders, and that fascinates me, and I just always am trying to be, more effective, I suppose, and have more – so for me, my driver is of people and transformation. How can I help other people? So I love working on with my own team and understanding what makes them tick, and how can I help them personally become better at whatever it is they want to be better at. So
who's the last person you learned something from then? You say you've stalked people, and who've you sort of met recently, and you can't say Stephen because obviously you've known him for a while, but you know that you've suddenly gone, wow, there's somebody I could learn something from, somebody that's impressed you.
Annie Parker from Fishburners, she's current CEO of Fishburners, was previous founder of Miradi. She's always doing amazing things, and she just has an ability to stand, like she brings her personal brand into whatever company she's with, and she just stands up for stuff. You know, I love that. I'm not sure. And I think, what am I actually stand for? So it makes me look at my own self and then, to learn different ways that people can influence people or lead better teams or execute on bigger projects. She's a good one for me. And we're good friends and we touch base, which is really nice. But, she's always doing amazing things.
Who would you like to meet? Who'd you sit there and go, if I could have lunch with them tomorrow, who would that be?
I do love Jamie Oliver. Always have, because you know why? I know it sounds like, I'm not sure if it's just cliche or what, but you know, it was just the influence globally that guy has had is true, phenomenal. And he's the only person I look at, and he's not a dickhead celebrity. He's just still true. Like, if you watch him, I don't know if he acts well or what, but he gets that excited every single time he cooks a meal and thinks it's the best thing he's ever tasted. And I just think that is so authentic. I do love him, and he's had huge impact and has changed, whole nations on how they look at food. It's like a massive, huge influence.
There's a great point there, is that if you take that passion, enthusiasm with everything that you do.
Yeah, but he's had it since he was like a teenager chef, and that has never changed. He just took a whole bunch of people with him and had impact. So, yes, people have impact.
It's hard to stay at that level. It's hard to stay at that level.
And he has stayed there, and he's still doing it. That's what gets me. So, yeah, massive, massive respect for him and admiration.
How do you stay? What do you do to chill out or stay focused in terms of exercise? What kind of helps you recharge?
So I was speaking to this recently with someone else in here at Rubicity Labs, because we focus, you know, with entrepreneurs, trying to get them like peak performance. It's like working with athletes. So how do you get in the right frame of mind and personal state of being to be able to perform? So in my head, every day that I step foot in here, I need to perform. I need to have my game face on, and I need to be ready to go from the moment the lift opens on level three. So regardless of whatever else has gone on at home, and sometimes that can be a lot, I need to walk in here and perform every single day. I don't have enough time in the day to fuck it up. Yeah. I have to literally walk in and go. So for me, my alarm goes off at 3:50 every morning. I go to the gym. So I get up. And that's the reason I do that is not because I'm just crazy insane.
Oh, sorry, you're going to the gym at 3. You're getting 50. Up at 3:50 3:50
a.m. because I go to the gym. I've got between 4 and 5 a.m. That's my only window.
That's dedication.
Because for me, I have to be physically fit to get my head to be in the right frame of mind.
Yeah.
It just makes me feel super positive and pumped every single day. Love it. But I got sick of making excuses that I don't have time, or, you know, toddlers waking up or whatever it is. So I've worked out he wakes up at 5, so I have to go to the gym, and my husband goes to work super early, so I also don't have the luxury of backup of any people at home. So I've got to leave my kids somewhere. So I work out that I can go between 4 and 5 a.m. and I'm back for 5. My husband goes to work, and then I do the morning shift with the kids, get everyone to, you know, fed, breakfast, to school. Then I come in here and I spend the day in here, and then when I go home, I switch hats, and then it's on for the next few hours. Like literally from the moment I walk in the door, it's like homework, dinner and bed, or talk to the kids or whatever it might be. And then when they go to bed, then I think about myself again and maybe, I don't know, get ready for the night or do some more work. And that's pretty much how it works. So if I'm not physically in like peak performance, I don't think I could get through that entire day.
No, I've got one at 18 months now, and that's been a revelation.
Yeah. And you know how busy it is, right? Yeah. It's just, and preparation is the other thing I do. So I have a whole family to run and keep everyone's, you know, I'm also, I like to make sure everyone's fed really well. So I have Sunday is my prep day. I do all the meals for the week. Get the kids' lunches ready for the week. It's super organized. Everyone knows what's happening, so that on any given day, whoever's, you know, at the home with the kids, whether it's myself, my husband, or one of our babysitters, or my parents, they know what the meal is for the day, where it is, so it can just run. Because as soon as there's a gap, and it can be a window of half an hour, everything can go to shit if it's not sort of right. But don't get me wrong, it's not like, you know, military standards where, you know, it's bang, 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 and no one's got room for a bit of free time. It's not like that. But for my own sanity, I have to have it that well planned, because I've only got a small window to go and shop as well. So I've got to know what I need to get it sorted, you know, what's coming up for the kids that week, so that when I walk in here, I know that all of that's sorted and I can focus 100% on work the time that I'm here.
That's sensational. I mean, again, you know, the role that you're in and what you're doing at home and balancing all that is, you know, is awesome that's that there's so many people, and I certainly don't want it to sound, you know, sexist anyway. There's certainly many people, male and female, who would never be able to, you know, even grasp the getting their head around that kind of thing.
Look, yeah, and you know, I love a challenge. So for me, it's just another job. So I'm like, right, how can I make this week best, whatever? And so, but don't get me wrong, there's weeks where things just do not work. Something doesn't work, or, you know, something's on the weekend, and if I don't get to prep, then it's all just, you know, ad hoc during the week, and you just have to sort of make it up as you go. But the ideal week is when it's forward planned, everyone knows what's going on, and it should work. But everyone with a family knows that's the best case scenario, and you just have to adapt and shift when it doesn't work out.
We're coming to the end, but there's a couple of things I just want to sort of ask you in terms of summing this up. And you've given us some really good advice throughout in terms of how you do things and lessons you've learned. But if you sat down and you have a startup or any business, and let's not let's keep talking about startups because there's lots of businesses out there being run for 20 years that still need help.
Yeah.
What are your three key pieces of advice to people who run businesses and own businesses?
Customers is always the biggest thing. You'd be so many, and customers' feedback. So are your customers happy? What do they actually want? And are you delivering that? Are you the best person to be delivering that? You'd be surprised, but a lot of people would be surprised that they don't talk to their customers enough, or especially if his business has been around for a while. Yeah. They just assume that their customer's happy. And they keep delivering the same sort of service and not working with them to constantly, you know, reiterate products and come up with better versions or get feedback from them and make them feel included on the journey. I think that is one thing that the traditional business world can learn from the startup world, is that startups base everything around customer feedback. And if they don't, then they sort of don't have a business at all. Whereas traditional businesses that may have existed for a while may have lost a bit of touch. Not everyone, but some do for sure. And in that, they could lose, you know, some customers, but also be wiped out by someone who does come in with a you know, more fresh or younger product or something that's more technically savvy or completely disrupt their whole sector. So, customers, absolutely number one. And that comes from, I'm talking running a cafe to a huge organisation. The customers are at the forefront every single time. And staff, culture, internal culture is massive. If you don't have happy people who understand what, one, the company exists for, two, what their boss even likes or does or why they are even in business, then you can't expect the staff to be on board with any of the internal culture or focus. I think transparency is massive. The more you talk about why it is you're doing what you're doing, what makes you tick, then you can understand what makes them tick and help them to achieve their own personal goals. I'm huge on enabling staff to follow whatever it is. So even in here, I'd love any of the staff that work with me to have this as a platform to launch their next thing. I know that I'm not going to have them forever. But if they can learn something while they're here or perhaps go out on their own and they've acquired some skills along the way, that for me is huge success culturally.
Final couple of questions then. I've asked this to everyone, brands that you like. Now, I'll put this in context because you can't say River City Labs. And it only has to be one. But what I'm interested in is something that you buy on a regular basis, something that you always gravitate to, you know, that you're obviously impressed with. And I think with a brand, it's something that you feel comfortable with, that you know that the quality is going to be there, or the level of consistency, we've spoken about that earlier on, is always going to be there. Something that you look at and just go, that's what I would aspire to from a brand perspective.
Oh, that's hard. I should have thought about
this one. It's a teacher to read the questions when I send them to you.
Because I know. Look, and I know I'm going to sort of think of 20 of them when I finish this talk, but I think there's the brand that does really well at the moment is the Thank You brand. At the moment, so, you know, I've got a kid in nappies, so I buy the Thank You nappies.
Is that the guy that started out with the Thank You Walter?
And
right. I've heard him
water,
talk, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's a social enterprise model. They, I think the fact, okay, so nappies are a bit shit. You feel bad, landfill. I've used, you know, cloth nappies, disposable. I've used the whole thing. But if I'm going to go down the route of having disposable nappies, I want to have something. I want to make sure I'm helping someone somewhere because I know it's, you know, so they dedicate, I don't actually know the actual breakdown of what they donate back to, you know, to their charity. So just knowing that something's going somewhere opposed to Huggies is going to wherever it goes to with Huggies, you know, and all the other brands. Plus also just better materials and ethically sourced and looking after people who make them, those sort of things I think are super important in today's day and age. I will not support any of the bigger brands like Johnson & Johnson and Huggies just because I know that they're shit and they don't treat their people right and they're toxic chemicals and all that sort of stuff. I love the Flannery's brand. I'm not sure if it's just Queensland or Australia, but in terms of they started off as a really small health food store, but now they are, I think, will be quite a large, you know, independent supermarket chain, just with again, supporting other brands that are doing everything for the right reasons. Yes, it's more expensive. But, man, if we, you know, we just need more people creating more opportunities like that to now the small to enable smaller brands to showcase their products, but also just to, you know, to eat better and use less chemicals and all that sort of stuff. So I'm big on that sort of stuff.
Have you been in a?
So I love what they're doing.
Obviously, been in Whole Foods in the. I remember walking into Whole Foods for the first time.
I know.
Yeah, 10 years
ago. Exactly. And you look at what we've got here in Australia, you just think, why? Especially when we have access to so much amazing stuff. So I really hope that the Flannery's brand really goes gangbusters in the future or someone similar like that, you know, to push it. I don't know why the hell Coles and Woolies is so big still. What else? As far as, you know, consumable stuff, like I really love the Oreton brand. I always have something about it. It's like it's quality. I don't think I've ever been disappointed when I've had something there, like from wallets to handbags.
That's good. Well, considering you've got those three off the top of your head, that's pretty good. So last couple of questions. I mean, obviously, you've only just become CEO, but that's a fairly recent sort of graduation, isn't it? There's obviously a lot of work for you to still do at River City, but what's next for you? Where do you see yourself, you know, going to in the next sort of 5-10 years?
It's like 12 months, I think I've been back, or maybe a bit more. It was June of 20 whatever last year. Yes. So, and I came back with a sole purpose to get this facility up and running because it was something I felt was unfinished when I left on maternity leave, and I wanted to come in and nail it because I had such, you know, a big vision for what I wanted it to be. So now that we're in here and we're, you know, filled it out really well, we've got amazing programs. For me, the next step is how do we remain relevant beyond a space, beyond this one facility, and have greater impact into the ecosystem and also the whole sector to keep. I think we've got a massive responsibility to founders and entrepreneurs to keep delivering value and connections and quality content for them. So I would love to expand what we do here at Ruisa Labs into other regions and other locations, and not so much setting up other facilities, but work with other organisations who are everywhere else. So we've got a lot to offer in the type of programs that we run in here. We've had some amazing results. The quality of them is really high. We focus on getting the right people to facilitate those programs. So I would love to expand that more so that River City Labs has a broader reach more than just here in the Brisbane CBD.
You're off to London soon, aren't you? Or is that?
Yes, I'm taking a group of probably 15 female founders to London, which will be amazing. I was there in June for London Tech Week on one of the Startup Catalyst trips.
Yeah.
And I'm taking another group of just women. And the reason for that is, you know, we don't have as many female founders in the ecosystem as we like, but also there is amazing women in business. There are a lot of people with small businesses, but we want to shift their thinking to understand that they have everything that they need right now to be creating globally relevant companies. They just need to think bigger. And by taking them and dropping them into the center of like one of the largest startup ecosystems, you can't not unthink what or unsee what you see over there. And when you come back, you can't go back in and just create it, you know, keep working on your small business. You have to do bigger and you have to do better things. So it's more that cultural transformation, and it's really life-changing experience. So I'm really looking forward to sharing that with all the women that come along.
That's going to be a trip and a half, isn't it?
I know. Well, the last one I went on, it was mixed, and yes, so all women. I think already it's different because they ask so many questions, they're super organised.
Yeah.
So the feel of it's different already in just the application process and selection and pre-planning. Plus we're connecting with some amazing women over there too. So there's amazing VCs, amazing entrepreneurs in London. And the government, you know, UK government are rolling out the red carpet for us on so many occasions. So it's going to be it's going to be quite significant for the women that come. So I'm super keen to understand what I want to, you know, see what they're doing in 6 months' time on the back of getting back from that trip.
And if people want to see that, are you going to sort of document that trip? Are you going to
I'll be writing some stuff while away, but the women will be encouraged to obviously part of the mandate of Startup Catalyst is to give back and share their learnings into the ecosystem upon return in whatever format that is best for them.
I think what we need is a hashtag.
Yeah.
I think we're going to need an Instagram hashtag for all of the women
there
going.
There will be. Yeah, there will be. There will be to track us. Yeah. I know what it was like. Most of the days are so jam-packed.
Yeah.
The intention is to break people. Not in a bad way, but just to mentally break down how they think by pushing them to the limits. Like the program itself is exhaustive on purpose so that people don't have time to go to their computer and slip into normal mode and answer emails. So that when we do go out for, have a wine at the end of the day, they get to debrief and process everything they saw during the day. And that's where the magic happens.
Well, extremely jealous that you're going to get to go to London.
Yeah.
I'm not so jealous about what the weather's going to be like by the time you get there.
I know, it's going to be different from June, but I will take
a
jacket.
I went back in August and within about 3 days suddenly realised why I'd left there. But,
so November
is high summer. Yeah. It'll still be fantastic.
I'll come back into the heat of December.
If people want to talk to you, find you, what's the best way of tracking you down or stalking you?
I'm on Twitter, which is Ellis Peter, and then I am on email and then obviously at River City Labs every single day. So if people want to drop in, they can do that. But sending me an email to book a time if they actually want to have a chat is probably the best way. But if you want to just say, hey, Twitter's also great. Same with Instagram. You'll get spammed with all pics of my wife and kids on there as well. So just be prepared that happens.
Children's spam, baby spam.
Yeah, children's spam, beach. You know, I love going down the coast and I spam people with my life down there.
It has been absolutely fantastic. It's been way too long since you and I had a long conversation like this, and it was as interesting, perhaps 10 times more interesting than I already anticipated it would be. So just want to say thank you for your comments, your ideas, the stories, and absolutely everything. I hope you have a fantastic time in London.
Yes, thank you.
And, thank you. Thank you once again for your time.
No, thank you. It's been good. Every time I do one of these chats, especially this one, I'm not sure why, maybe because you know me from way back then, I do actually learn more about myself. So thank you for that. I do enjoy revisiting some of those older eras of my journey.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
That's pretty much it for today. I hope you've enjoyed the interview. I hope you enjoyed the spin cycle. This was the episode 4 of the Simon Dell Show. Just before we wrap up, my usual little tip, tool, thing, article that I found, and now I'm going to be completely honest with you that I haven't actually tried this one out. So I'm actually going to recommend something or suggest you have a look at something that I haven't tried out. So there you go. So you can probably don't trust me and switch off right now. But if you do want to check it out, and the reason I'm recommending this is because it just looked good. That's why you should be recommending a piece of software. But it's called Plutio. Now that's spelled Plutio.com. It is a project manager, tasking, invoice filing platform. It pretty much does all those things. It's been specifically designed for freelancers and small teams, which is why it got me quite excited when I saw it. So look, I think you should go and have a look at it because it looks like it pretty much ticks all the boxes for what I'm looking for. I know there's a lot of project management software out there, but definitely worth having a look and getting and there's a 30-day free trial in there. Look, if you do like it and you think it's fantastic, please let me know. Certainly, if you've given it a good once over, we can check it out and get you on the show and get your opinion about it as well. Finally, some thank yous. We need to obviously thank Eddie and Patrick for co-hosting today. I also like to thank Gilberto. If you want to find out Gilberto, he is my sound engineer. www.welovesound.audio. He's got a huge amount of experience. If you need someone to help you out with your audio, he's the person person to talk to. Otherwise, you can find me on www.simondell.com. You can find me on LinkedIn. I am Simon Dell. You can find me on Twitter. I am Simon Dell. But most importantly, you can find the show on Instagram at Simon Dell Show. We post a lot of the stuff that we've talked about in the show today. And we also post some other random advertising marketing stuff that we find. Finally, if you get a chance, we would love for you to review and rate the show on iTunes. It would help us out extremely, a huge amount, and help us get in front and get listened to by more people. So that is pretty much for it today. We'll see you on the next episode of The Simon Dell Show. Thank you.